Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, welcome to those of you who are not normally here and welcome to those of you who are as well. My name's Tony Travers. I'm chairing this evening's event, which is called 10 years on, Brexit and Britain's political future. And I think I can say, judging by other programmes for other institutions I've seen in the coming weeks, you can do quite a lot of these events in the coming weeks, with several of our speakers here doubtless speaking at more than one of them. This is hosted by the Department of Government here at the LSE. It's an in-person and online public event, and I have one or two other things that I'm required to announce. It's a hashtag, which is somewhere... LSE events, there we are, for those of you who still do that. There are journalists here, welcome journalists, but for everybody else who didn't know that, there are journalists here who may be taking photographs and recording things. There is an exhibition, afterwards there'll be a drink, and with it an exhibition from the LSE Library's excellent collection of memorabilia and other important printed and other matter from that referendum 10 years ago. Before I introduce our distinguished panel, each of whom will speak for, so where the evening's going to work, about 4 or 5 minutes each, just to open up the issue, their thoughts on 10 years after this remarkable event in Britain's public life. And then I will talk to the panel for a bit, and then you can talk to the panel for longer. So it'll be interactive, this direction, this direction, this direction, and then for everybody, including those of you up there in the grand circle, as I like to think of it. So just to begin, it's easy to say these days that we've all lived through, or even everybody in this room pretty well, you don't have to be very old for this to be true anymore, a number of once-in-a-generation, or even once-in-a-lifetime events since 2008. The banking crisis, the Brexit referendum, you could even go include the Scottish referendum, the pandemic, Ukraine, and now what's going on in the Middle East. All of these things could be seen as once in a generation or even once in a lifetime. But there's no question that the Brexit referendum and what happened subsequently has probably had more impact and in more and different ways, not least of which because, as Sarah's excellent book, Tribal Politics, which is perched here, newly published in front of us, points out, it had the impact, an impact amongst others, on the economic impacts, all the political impacts, impacts on sovereignty, all the other things we're about to hear about. But it also effectively showed people that there were ways of voting that sort of cracked open the traditional left-right conservative Labour domination of politics, which had been with us since 1945, and two-party system distantly before that. So it's had a profound effect on British politics, and we'll doubtless explore that, the economic impact, what it tells us about campaigning, what it tells us about the United Kingdom, what it tells us about the EU. And our speakers are four people sitting here with me. So Emma Duncan writes a weekly column on economic and social policy at the Times, along with notebooks, essays and book reviews. She was formerly deputy editor of The Economist during the Brexit referendum. She founded the Wake Up and Vote, a campaign to encourage young people to vote. Noble work indeed. She's the author of Breaking the Curfew, Political Journey Through Pakistan, and is a visiting fellow of Nuffield College, Oxford. Matthew Lord Elliott is an alumnus of the LSE. He was co-founder and chief executive of the Vote Leave campaign, described by the Financial Times as one of the most formidable political strategists in Westminster, and by the New Statesman as one of the most successful and feared campaigners in British politics. You're looking very benign, I must say. He also led the successful No to AV referendum campaign and has set up numerous policy campaigns, including the Taxpayers Alliance, which is still out there, still working. Matthew's currently president of the Jobs Foundation and a member of the House of Lords. He's got a book coming out soon called 10 Years On, The Untold Story of Brexit. Will be told by then quite a lot, I suspect, but The Untold Story of Brexit, apart from your point of view, Reflections on a Life in Campaigning. So for those of you who want to go campaigning, get this book. Professor Sarah Holbolt is the Sutherland Chair in European Institutions, head of Department of Government at the LSE. She's a leading scholar of European and British politics, specialising in public opinion, political behaviour and populism. Currently serves as the president of the European Political Science Society and is the author of several books. Can you hold it up?
Just because mine is published before.
Tribal politics. So that one's already had an excellent launch do. And then, last but not least, Anna Menon is Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London. He's the Director of UK and a Changing Europe and has been for a number of years now. Think tank communicating in a non-partisan way, social scientific research on Brexit and the Brexit process. He's an associate fellow of Chatham House, senior associate member of Nuffield College, Oxford. Welcome to you both, all of you. I'm Tony Travers, enough of that. So, the running order, which we changed at the last minute, I'm going to ask Matthew for your 5 to 7. I said 3 to 5 minutes, so let's go
5 to 7. That's it.
Over to you.
Thank you, Tony. I'm feeling a sort of wave of nostalgia sitting on this stage again, though I always used to sit up there for lectures rather than on the stage, but it's very nice to be back at the LSE. And I was a student here from 1997 to 2000. I think it's worth just for a moment just slightly reminiscing about where British politics was back in the turn of the millennium. If you cast your mind back then, economically speaking, growth was at 3%, amazingly. We were paying off the national debt. You know, life was good within the UK. I think one of the key questions to understanding Brexit and why it happened in 2016 is to think about some of the longer term causes between the turn of the millennium, basically, and 2016. And it strikes me there are four that are worth really sort of focusing in on quickly. I'm sure we'll talk about them more. First one, of course, is the Great Financial Crisis. That point which saw sort of the average UK growth rate go from being, let's say, roughly speaking, 2-2.5% before then, to being more like, you know, 1-1.5% afterwards. And the fact that people's living standards basically didn't improve between the financial crisis in 2016 was, I think, a crucial element of their voting patterns come Brexit. Second point to pick up on would be the trust in politicians. And if you think back to just before the 2010 election in 2008, 2009, the height of the MPs' expenses scandal within the UK, again, that had confirmed perhaps a latent belief within the British population that their politicians weren't up to much good and were sort of snouts in the trough and all that sort of thing. And again, that was shaping how people viewed politics and politicians within the UK. That was another crucial dimension to the rise of the anti-politics feeling within the UK. And one of the other crucial things, perhaps the third one, would of course be migration. I'm sure about migration. And again, you'd have the East expansion of the EU. And at the time when that happened, Tony Blair talked about how he estimated that there'd be about 13,000 people who would come to the UK after Eastern expansion, and it ended up being more like 1.5 million. Now, we can debate whether that was a good or bad thing, but it was very different to what he presented to the British public. And again, that helped undermine people's confidence in politicians. And I say the fourth key thing, people were quite open-minded about David Cameron going to try and get a renegotiation. And if you looked at the polling in sort of 2015, it was basically about sort of 50-50, thereabouts, sort of leave, remain. But if you then ask the second question, if David Cameron comes back with a deal which he recommends to the British public as reforming the EU, how will you then vote? It then split to more like sort of 70-30 in favour of remain. Now, the fact he came back with a deal which didn't add up to very much meant that on his very own terms, when he kept on talking about how Britain would be better off out an unreformed EU, on his very own terms, he lost. So it's easy with these discussions like this to get into the minutiae of campaigning and, you know, the fact that Boris's role in the referendum played, or the fact that the Labour Party didn't really engage in the campaign that much under Jeremy Corbyn. all sorts of other factors we could talk about in terms of the minutiae of that year running up to the referendum. But I think those sort of four big picture points are quite helpful in terms of understanding why Brexit happened in 2016. And in terms of our strategy, I'll just keep this very, very brief because I know I haven't got very long. I'll actually blame Patrick Dunleavy for Britain leaving the EU. I don't know if he's in the room today.
First world colleague, government
maybe watching somewhere, perhaps. Patrick Dunleavy, Professor Patrick Dunleavy, taught me public choice theory when I was doing government here at the LSE. And I always remember his lectures on Anthony Downs and his economic theory of democracy, written in the sort of 1950s at some point, and talking about a two-party race and the median voter theorem and how in a two-candidate race, people have to sort of chase for that median vote in order to win that election. And that's very much how we approached the referendum campaign. There were people within the wider Leave community, those within UKIP, Nigel Farage, Leave.eu, urging a much more of a sort of core vote strategy. You know, drive out that core vote and win that way. What we did at Vote Leave was to realise that sort of, let's say, third of voters in the centre who leant towards a more Eurosceptic way of thinking, but perhaps had concerns about the economic impact. And crucially, they wanted to hear from politicians who had been sitting on the fence, people like, you know, Boris Johnson and Gisela Stewart and Michael Gove, people like that. By getting the right campaign together, appealing to those swing voters, having the right messengers out there like Boris Johnson, was crucial to our victory. And one final thought before I pass on. Am I still happy we left the EU? Yes, absolutely. So I think if you look at the longer-term position of Britain's place in the world, when we joined the common market back in the 1970s, the GDP of the nine member states at the time when we joined was 35% of the world's GDP. Currently, the 27 member states of the EU account for 15% of the world GDP, and that'll be 10% by 2040. So I'd much rather have a UK which is free to do trade deals with countries around the world and have that flexibility to take advantage of those trade deals going forward. Thank you.
Okay, Matthew, thank you very much. Sorry.
Thank you. I feel that Matthew didn't fully give himself enough credit for the campaign. But one thing just following on from that, which is interesting, was you were saying this sort of the third in the middle. And, of course, the thing about public opinion in Britain is that it was what, you know, I think we call in the book actually sort of soft indifference, soft scepticism. A lot of people could have gone either way. And what I'll say a little bit about is how the Brexit referendum, by compelling people to really take sides, you became, you know, some people felt very strongly either way, but most people actually didn't. Most people were quite critical of the EU, didn't love it. There wasn't a lot of love for the EU when you compare to sort of continental Europeans, but could be critical, but also perhaps a bit nervous about going it alone. But by asking people, no, you have to take a side, you have to be either a Leaver or a Remainer, that created a kind of polarization in politics that we hadn't seen around the EU question. And this is really what I've been interested in studying this over, not just the referendum itself, although I'm happy to talk more about this, and I share a lot of Matthew's analysis of what happened, but what happened afterwards in the last decade in British politics because of that, which is really quite remarkable, and which has gone beyond, of course, changing our relationship quite fundamentally with the European Union, but also changing us as a country domestically. And part of that is that 10 years on, we're not where we were 10 years ago, where a lot of people were like, oh, you know, I like this about the EU, I dislike that, so on. We really sort of became two different tribes, and I think certainly people who come out on this lovely, well, it's lovely right now, lovely evening, will probably know people, or maybe themselves still today, think of themselves as a Remainer or a Rejoiner or as a Brexiteer, or describe other people like that. And that is, for a referendum, quite remarkable, because normally these things fade and they don't turn into political identities the way in which the Brexit referendum did. And these labels have gone beyond describing just what we think about the membership of the EU, they've come to represent something more. And in this book, Tony very kindly promoted here for me. What James Tilley and I and my co-author do, we really look at some of the consequences. And I'll just point to three of them that I think is interesting. One is that it didn't only lead to a sense of belonging around being, let's say, for example, a Remainer or a Labour. It also led to an outgroup hostility. In other words, we began to think of people, you know, you might have been to a dinner party. You know, Matthew here, I can tell you, is a very charming man. And he might come to a dinner party in Wimbledon. You know about Wimbledon, where I live. It's quite Remainy. People might, with that alone, the fact that you let, sort of be a bit skeptical about him. That's certainly what we see from survey data. So people, sorry to personalize it, it's just that you're sitting right there. People would think of the other group, not just in terms of differing views in the EU, but they would use it in open-ended questionnaire terms like, oh, these people are idiots, they're gullible fools, they are xenophobes, they're racist, things like, and things that I can't even say sort of before the waters yet. So there was a kind of a stereotyping and a prejudice that came with this kind of new polarized politics around Brexit identity. A second thing is that it also affected how we still today look at the world around us, including, for example, economics. So many people say, well, you know, can't everyone see that this has been terrible for the economy? Now, what we see in polls is that how terrible you think it is for the economy is very much to do with how you voted and how you identified 10 years ago. So Remainers are generally, and was basically overnight, became so much more pessimistic about everything and have remained pessimistic. Whereas Leavers, they haven't become super optimistic, but they have remained a lot more optimistic. And part of that is just basic human psychology. We don't like to be wrong. So on both sides, we select facts and interpret facts that fit better with our worldviews. And a final thing which Tony touched upon is, I think, that even though Brexit is now, not a lot of politicians talk about it, although excitingly for people like us with books out, it seemed to have re-emerged a bit recently, West Reading, maybe because he wants to win a leadership contest, or has started talking about it in others. But it's not really a central issue, you'd think, in politics today. However, in some ways, I still think that Brexit and that vote caused a lot of the turmoil and fundamental change we're seeing in British politics today when we think of party competition. One reason is that by taking and adopting these new political identities, that still today, two-thirds of the people who voted 10 years ago still hold, and hold more strongly than, say, being a Labour or Conservative supporter. That meant that people were willing often to go against their party view. So if you were a Conservative, for example, you would have been very confused. Who do you support, David Cameron or Boris Johnson? So you had to, almost regardless of what you chose, you would go against your partisan view. Or similarly, if you were a Labour leaver, you would go against the majority of your party. And once you've done that once, that meant that an already long-term historical trend of weakening partisan identities were accelerated by this Brexit vote. And the kind of also parliamentary turmoil we saw that cut across the kind of party politics we're used to in Britain, with Labour and Conservative dominating. And I think so what we just saw, for example, in the local elections very much showed that people are so much more volatile, much less loyal to their parties. And when we see where they go when they abandon the Conservatives and now Labour, they go very much according to their Brexit tribe. So if you're a Leaver, you go to Reform. And if you're a Remainer, you go to the Lib Dems or the Greens from Labour and the Conservatives. So in that way, Brexit still, even though it's not dominating our headlines or our daily lives in the way we think about politics, it is still, I would argue, for many people, an underlying issue that matters, and that matters in a way that could still be mobilised and could still polarise depending on the political choices we are facing in the future.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. And Emma.
Tony, thank you very much. Great privilege to be here. Also to be sitting next to a man who's writing his notes in longhand on House of Lords headed paper.
Very old school.
Unlike most very enthusiastic Remainers, I had a really enjoyable referendum campaign because, as Tony said, I ran a campaign to get young people out to vote, and this involved rustling up supporters like Keira Knightley and Lily Cole, who did videos for us, and also a gentleman I hadn't previously heard of called The Big Nasty, whose video was, I think, the most watched that anybody made in the campaign. I like to think that that helped boost the young vote enormously. Actually, young people voted far more in the referendum than they did in the previous election or the subsequent one, and the increment with young people was much bigger than it was with older people, which probably doesn't demonstrate that we were fantastically successful, but does at least demonstrate that it's something that young people minded very much about at the time. And I think still do mind about. Although I did enjoy my referendum campaign, when Tony asked me to join this panel, my instinctive reaction was, no, I really don't want to go back there, because, you know, I think, you know, as Sarah's pointed out, you know, for many of us, it was a far more emotional experience than we had anticipated. And for Remainers, an extremely upsetting one. And, you know, one which, I guess, you know, still a little bit feels for me like a bereavement that I haven't quite got over. And I, you know, I lost friends during the campaign. So, you know, it's not something that I really felt like going back to. But as the other speakers have said, it was fantastically formative in what our country's become like. And just, you know, just off the top of my head, because I don't have my notes on House of Lords headed paper in front of me, so I lost them on my phone. You know, the referendum, Brexit, was both cause and consequence. It's hard to say that it's actually itself, purely by itself, caused lots of the things that have happened in this country. I think, like most important things politically, it was the consequence of things that were happening in the country, and it has caused things. You know, Trump is the consequence of what America's like now, and he is also making it different. And I think in a similar way, Brexit was both consequence and cause. And just, you know, a stream of things that came into my mind: disillusionment with government, distrust of politicians, higher immigration, more regulation, insecurity, uncertainty, and anxiety, which have led to risk aversion among households and businesses that you can see in the numbers. The rise of culture and the decline of class as structural dividing lines in our parties, the decline of the two main parties, political instability, and a general erosion of the good opinion in which Britain has generally been held by the rest of the world. Most of those are not good things, and I'm sure there are more that we will touch on.
Thank you, Emma. And last but not least, again, Anna.
Thanks, Tony. I find it really hard to reflect on Brexit. I mean, having sort of lived through it blow by blow, looking back is really, really difficult. But I'll make just three quick reflections on things that strike me now when I try and sort of put a distance between myself and what's been happening. The first is just how weird it is that we've ended up where we are, in the sense that we've left the European Union, but we're basically aligning with the vast majority of EU rules without that giving us market access. And sort of intuitively, you can see the point of a Brexit where you leave in order to pursue your own rules free from the regulatory orbit of Brussels, or you can see a point in staying in. We've ended up in a very weird place where we've left, but our rule book doesn't reflect that at all, that we're still mirroring EU rules, despite the fact that mirroring EU rules, as I said, doesn't give you access to the single market, which is not what I would have put my money on my Brexit bingo card in 2016, of all the outcomes I would have expected. The second thing about Brexit, and this is the perennial thing about Brexit, is it involves a lot of very tricky trade-offs. And if you look at the debate about our relationship with the European Union now, all those trade-offs that haunted the referendum are there again. And it's essentially a trade-off between autonomy and market access. we can stay where we are now, and we can suck up the impact that this is having on trade. We now have the data to show that this is having on trade. We can go fully autonomous and regulate our own economy, but that will impact on our ability to trade with the EU still more, because we'll have a different rule book from the European Union. Or, as some people in the Labour Party are saying, I mean, lots of people in the Labour Party are saying it and not meaning it, let's be honest about this, there's a leadership contest to be won, and you've got a very pro-European membership to appeal to. So I would treat everything said about the EU in this contest with a pinch of salt. We can move closer to the European Union and try and address some of the economic impacts of Brexit. The problems there are, if you think where we are now is weird, if we end up inside the single market being a rule taker across the board 10 or 15 years after a referendum that's centred on the issue of control, that would be weirder still, I suspect. Or we can go sort of full fat, if you like, as Wes Streeting alluded to, and talk about rejoining. All I would say about that is, for those people who say rejoin as if it's something you just do and it's quite easily and painless, think again. Rejoining will be a nightmare. The European Union is not in the habit of doing favours to third countries. They're certainly not in the habit of doing favours to us. I still sort of in a slight sense of shock about the fact that we're paying £500 million to access Erasmus for a year. And the European Union will negotiate in exactly the same way when it comes to any putative membership agreement from us. They will negotiate hardball, and they will make the terms suit them and not suit us. So as ever with Brexit, you've got to face these trade-offs. If you want market access, you're going to pay a political and perhaps financial cost. And the problem is, you know, as China's neighbours find, as the US neighbours find, if you're on the doorstep of a continental-sized economy, despite the fact that David Cameron wanted us to stop banging on about Europe, we never, ever will, because that continental-sized economy on our doorstep is there forever, and it will continue to shape our possibilities, our options, the world around us, whether we like it or not. The final thing I'd say very quickly is that, this builds on what Emma and Matthew were saying, is that Brexit, in some ways for me, was a massive squandered opportunity. Brexit was about many things, but it was partly at least a protest against the status quo in this country. I remember one moment during the campaign where George Osborne did a couple of interventions. In one, he said Brexit would hurt the City of London. And in another, he said if we leave the European Union, house prices would come down. And a mate of mine from school in West Yorkshire rang me up and said, has Osborne changed sides? Because they sound like good things to me. And that kind of brought home to me the fact that there were two, certainly, Englands. And one England, in a sense, in that referendum, rose up and said, you know what, things aren't working for us. And just to link to the second part of the title of tonight's event, which is about the impact of this on the future of politics, we should not in the least be surprised that populist parties are doing very well in the polls in this country. Because 10 years after a seismic referendum, where the people signalled as clearly as they ever have, this isn't working, do something about it, we've done nothing about it. And so they're trying other options again. And frankly, who can blame them?
Thank you. Admirably short and direct and to the point. So I want to open some of these points out a bit, particularly in the matter of, in a sense, and I have to put this to you first, Matthew. I mean, what those who were, you will have heard many, many times before, those who say that Brexit was a mistake will say that all the people who were arguing for it were arguing for something different, and the people who were voting for Remain just wanted to leave everything as it was yesterday. So what were the things that, since you feel were the major benefits that would flow from a Brexit, and how's it going so far?
I think a good number of benefits.
I was tempted to, you know, so because, go for it.
Okay. How long do we have?
Well,
to the rest of the session. First key point, you know, Brexit was about taking back control. Yep. And that's about basically who determines laws within the UK. That was a crucial point. Now, how you decide to use this power when you have it back is determined by who's in office in Number 10 and in Parliament. And those people may do things which I disagree with. So, for example, having VAT on school fees isn't allowed within the European Union, within the single market, because the Labour Party brought that in. I disagree with that, but they've used that power for that reason. Or it could be things which I agree with. So, for example, making changes to the Habitats Directive to allow faster building would be a good thing, in my view. or, for example, some of the differences we have with the EU in terms of tech law and AI law, meaning that we now got, you know, just down the road here at King's Cross, you know, hugely booming tech sector within the UK. Those have been undoubtedly good things. So actually having control within the UK is a good thing and well worth fighting for, in my view. First point. Second point, you have to say the membership fee, which would now be £22 billion with the rebate. We wouldn't get the rebate. Again, let's face it, the market had to negotiate, it's more like £28 billion. So for anybody who sort of sits and says we should you know, rejoin the EU, it's a key question about where will you raise that £28 billion from for the membership fee. And in terms of the trade deals, we have had some significant success with trade deals. And on the question of trade, I think it's worth noting that in that sort of 10-year period since Brexit, we've grown faster, our trade has grown faster than any country across the world except Canada, their OECD figures. So actually trade from the UK has increased. I think that's a good thing. So I'm pleased that's happened, but that's partly down to the trade deals we've got.
You know, I expect or hope that, because one of the most beguiling ideas about voting leave was that it would allow Britain to free itself. You referred to this yourself, from all these constraints of the EU, and go for sort of much more free market, drop tariff barriers and make the economy different. That didn't happen.
I think we could do a lot more on that front. I think, for example, Tony Blair in his essay that he wrote the other week was basically saying, you know, forget rejoin the EU and seeing that as a comfort blanket to get growth back. There are more fundamental questions about Britain's size of the state, you know, government spending, levels of taxation, regulation. He pointed about the regulation about AI and tech and that sort of thing in particular. He talked about those wider points about getting growth going. So, yes, we could do a lot more with it.
Okay. And on the matter of trade, and particularly, you were mentioning the UK beginning to align again with EU rules and regulations, and you know, every time I try to take a top off a plastic bottle and the cap won't come off, I think somebody's making a decision here to follow the EU rules rather than go it alone in Britain with the plastic top.
You would go it alone with the...
I'm just putting it out there.
There are points of principle, Zara.
So, how far is this alignment? I mean, because they completely contradict, as I'm not saying you, but they're it's contradicting the very idea of the free market version of going it alone, being able to be nimble, change the economy, and yet, in the end, governments have been constrained to stick with the economy, done surprisingly little. Question.
I mean, governments have done surprisingly little. There was, of course, a battle in the Conservative Party about this over the retained EU law bill, which was implemented in a very, very watered-down fashion. And the Labour government obviously wants to align as far as possible. I mean, with a few exceptions, so there's tech policy, as Matthew was saying. There's also financial services where we've diverged a little bit. But it has failed to happen. And one of the reasons I think it's failed to happen was because of politics and the nature of the Brexit coalition. I mean, for many years, if you go right back to the sort of roots of Tory Euroscepticism was about regulation. It was about the Brussels monolith imposing all these laws upon us, which make our economy less competitive. And if you think back to things like the Fresh Start Group, it was all about, we can leave the European Union, we can slash all those regulations, and we can free ourselves and become a more competitive economy. The problem was that to achieve Brexit, there needed to be a coalition that went a lot wider than those Tory Eurosceptics. So those people had to ally themselves with a whole load of people. We talk about the Red Wall far too much, but, you know, northern voters and people in less well-off parts of the country who didn't necessarily share that ideological leaning towards deregulation. So another paradox about Brexit was, to achieve it, you had to build a political coalition with people who didn't achieve with the original goals of the first Eurosceptics, which is why I think under Boris Johnson, the politics meant it was very, very hard to push through that kind of measure. I remember one of the totemic bits of regulation that the EU produced that the Eurosceptics, as they were then called, hated, was the Working Time Directive. The Working Time Directive is still on our statute books. It's still on our statute books because, of course, a lot of the people who voted for Boris Johnson quite like having a Working Time Directive. So the coalition needed to win was very different, if you like, in ideological makeup.
And the coalition that needed to win, the thing that the Leave vote clearly got right is that they played rather more on emotion and certainly less on the economic horrors. You mentioned the George Osborne, which even he, I think, I watched a film the other night where he was sort of admitting this didn't go down well. That's because I think the Leave side thought it was great when Osborne said all this stuff about
Project Fair.
Yeah. Mm. So am I right in thinking that in a sense, two sides were fighting on slightly different terms, one on the economy and rationality, or pure rationality, and the other more emotional, more driven by people's feelings?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing is that the Leave...
Sorry. Was that for me? Well, no, it's...
Sorry.
Sarah.
Go.
I was getting carried away. Sorry, my fault.
Well, maybe different. I mean, fear is also an emotion. You know, and that was, I think, very deliberate strategy, and it was partly a strategy that came from what they saw as a very successful campaign in Scotland. And they thought, okay, we can scare the Scots to staying in the Union, we can scare the Brits to stay. And that, but if you compare, to sort of analyze the two campaigns, and Matthew can tell us about the sort of the brains behind it, it was much more hopeful and optimistic than the Remain campaign. So if you just look at the Leave campaign, was much more, you know, we can do things better, we can change it for the better. So I think there was emotions in both, in the sense that trying to scare people is also an emotion, but I think what, from this sort of an academic point of view, would look very successful. That's not, and that sort of, you went beyond downs, so the downs is getting the middle, but there was also an optimism in your campaign. Was that deliberate?
There was also, look at the Scottish referendum, it's also looking at that. I think it was a misreading of that by David Cameron and Number 10. Yeah. They were. They thought it was a great, successful campaign. They sort of kept Scotland as part of the union. But actually, if you look at the voting, it had gone from being sort of, roughly speaking, like 30% for independence to being 45% for independence during the course of the campaign. And actually, sort of, was it 3 weeks out, 2 weeks out? It looked like independence was in the lead. It was actually Gordon Brown coming in and doing actually a very different style of campaigning for those final 2 weeks, which arguably swung things around in favour of the union. So I think they misread that campaign and actually then took those lessons into the referendum. And their Project Fair approach, yes, it was focused on the economy. It was also Project Fair about the, I don't remember, the David Cameron's World War III speech at the British Museum. It went too over the top. It wasn't believable.
Can I just pick up on your question to Matthew about how things are going? I mean, I think it's worth trying to pin down what has happened to the economy as a result of Brexit. And obviously, there have been masses of studies of this. The more recent ones tend to attribute a larger decline in a larger chunk of money that is not there in the economy that would have been if we hadn't left. The paper which I think has been taken most seriously has been done by principally by some economists at Stanford and published by the American Bureau of Economic Research. And it takes two approaches. So there's one approach which is looking at macro consequences. So basically you compare Britain to other economies and you try and select economies that kind of look more like Britain than other ones. That comes up with an 8% decline in the economy from where it otherwise would have been. I think that is not an entirely satisfactory approach because there are particular factors in Britain that result from our particular politics that you can't replicate in other countries. So I think more interesting in that paper is the microeconomic analysis, which took 7,000 companies, divided them into those that were more and less exposed to the EU, and on that basis came up with a 6% of the economy that isn't there and that otherwise would have been there.
Can I pick up on this?
You can.
I think it's really important.
Go for it.
Yep. It's interesting, that sort of first modelling you were talking about, the 8% modelling, and it sounds very logical. You sort of think, you know, what would have happened had Britain sort of voted to remain in the EU? And you may say, OK, well, let's think we're a bit like sort of the German economy and the French economy. Perhaps we would have tracked, you know, those economies had we remained in the EU. No. What this study does, they say, actually, the UK is like the US economy and the Estonian economy. Now, I wish we had the low energy costs of the US. I wish we had the tax simplification and transparency of Estonia. If we had those things within the UK, we would be growing much faster. So I think though that paper, which I've read, was very interesting. It always assumes that had we voted Remain, all of a sudden our economic growth would have taken off. And nothing else tells me that it would have, in the sense that all the key problems about UK economic growth, size of the state, taxation, etc., would still have been there.
But Matthew, that's exactly why I said I wasn't resting my analysis on the macro picture, yeah, but on their micro analysis, which I thought looked more reliable.
And I
was using micro analysis, but...
Surprisingly few, I'm sure you're going to cite one back at me, but not as, let's put it this way, and it's slightly, again, anecdotal, not as many economic analyses showing a big growth in the economy since Brexit than some contraction or growth below the trend that would otherwise have occurred. Is that fair?
And we've grown faster than Germany, France, Italy, other Western European economies,
but not as fast,
which
as
are similar to us.
So
the idea that Project
FAIR...
Well, per capita, that gets into an entirely different debate about migration, but yeah, overall, we've grown faster.
OK, let's move on to move the subject on a bit, and I promise we'll come to the audience soon. We're nearly halfway through the evening. Emma, you mentioned, because you work with young people to get them out to vote, and on, Anna will correct me, broadly, as in so many things these days, age is a major predictor of voting. So I'm guessing... Yeah. Younger, more likely, yeah, to want to stay in. And we've seen subsequently that the figures, according to most of the polling, have tilted away from 52-48 towards something nearer 65-70, 30-35. Is that right?
It's kind of, it's 58-59.
I think it's a good idea rather than hold a referendum.
Are we on stay as Remainers versus...
I was actually moving on to... was it a good idea or bad idea?
Sorry.
Which takes us away from having to argue about should we have another referendum. Is was it a good idea or a bad idea? And that shift presumably must embrace more than just the young hardening up their views, but includes people who were older who've changed their minds.
Yes. Anna, do you want to do this?
I mean...
Not a lot of people have changed their minds.
No. Yeah,
right. So why are these numbers shifted?
Well, because some have changed their minds, but also it's demographic.
Sorry, say it again. Sorry.
Well, of the people who have changed their minds, they're more likely to be either the people who didn't have a view, like the people who didn't vote, or who just didn't. Like, not a lot of people who voted for Leave changed their minds. I mean, it's just a few percentage points if we look at panel surveys. But the demographic change is one uniformly in the direction that the people sadly passed away in the last 10 years were much more likely to be
the people
who entered.
The
people you mobilised are much more likely to be Remainers. But it's not a huge shift in people who voted in 2016 to change their minds.
Okay.
But there are people who were indifferent, and of the people who didn't vote, they have swung much more.
Okay.
Which is surprising, actually, because normally people like to be on the winning side. But not,
yes.
Everybody
voted
people
for Walter Mondale,
didn't vote. I voted for, but that's actually gone the other direction.
Okay, before I turn to the audience, I'd like to ask this question. We discussed this before. So, much has been written, this book is in part, I'm sure your book is in part, about the political forces for change that have been unleashed by the referendum and what has followed. So, kind of counterfactual, if there had been no such referendum, therefore no outcome, how would these forces have manifested themselves otherwise? What would have happened instead? Would they just have gone away, or would they have appeared as something else, somewhere else? I know this is hypothetical and nobody can know the answer, but we like hypotheticals.
You go. I think that's a pretty easy question to answer, in the sense that if you look at... political parties within most Western democracies, they have changed over that sort of, let's say, 20-25 year period. When I was working in the European Parliament, this was in the sort of early 2000s, about a year or two, I remember the European People's Party being there and the Party of European Socialists being big, and these sort of major, sort of moderate, mainstream, centre-right and centre-left parties. Now the makeup is very different. Politics within the EU, but also America, and the UK to a certain extent, has gone to the extremes. So you see the rise of the Greens and the Communists and the Socialists and what have you. On the right, you see the rise of the populist right and the far right, some would say, in different countries. So that's happened in every country. So we would have seen a similar thing in the UK because we've had the same forces like the financial crisis.
But do you think, therefore, reform and restore would become even more likely to be further to the extreme to take account of the fact that Brexit hadn't happened?
And undoubtedly, the pressure to have a Brexit vote would have continued.
Okay.
I completely agree with Matthew. And I think we've seen it quite a good illustration of the forces behind this in the in Farage's horrible reaction to the death of Henry Novak. Rage. There is a lot of rage out there, and social media drives people to extremes, and I think that we would have seen much of this without... I think you could see it before the Brexit referendum beginning to happen, and I think it would have continued without it.
Okay. Any thoughts?
I think my only thought is that Cameron called the referendum because he wanted to keep the Tory party together. Remember, they were losing people. They lost Douglas Carswell and Mark Reckless to UKIP. And I think the real worry was that the Conservatives would end up splitting or losing significantly more MPs. So that was the rationale behind it. So I think if he hadn't had the referendum, there was a real danger that was happening. I think there were about 100 Tory MPs in the early part of that parliament who rebelled against the government on a vote on the supremacy of EU law. So the Conservative, the survival of the Conservative Party looked open to question at the time.
Oh, it does
not. Not only then, that's another matter, and indeed the Labour Party, to be fair.
Yeah. So? I mean, I think it's right that, of course, we've seen the same trends across Europe that we are now seeing here. I mean, the big difference in Britain really was the electoral system that put a brake on it, and also therefore parties, including both the Labour and the Conservative Party, held together these quite big disparate coalitions. And I do think Brexit accelerated that. So in a sense, I do think Brexit has accelerated that because it just showed, both at the population level but also at the party level, that these parties were split along this sort of second cultural dimension that you referred to.
Yes.
And so in that sense, and allowed people, actually we can do something else. So the underlying trends are very much what we see, across Western democracies. But I think that the first-past-the-post system and the way people and parties responded kind of held on to this sort of two-party dominance model for longer, and then Brexit sort of blew that up.
But I think probably the consequence of the electoral system will be greater instability in the future, greater disillusionment with the political system than you will see in countries with proportional voting systems, because you will have insane swings election after the next.
No, of course, because you referred to the European Parliament. So in the European Parliament, you have this fragmentation and polarization, but it's all still run by the same parties as when you were there, which is the EPP and the Socialists and Democrats and the Liberals. And that's what you see in a lot of continental Europe. You get the extremes, but you get quite broad coalitions because that's the only way you get a majority. Whereas here, of course, if we keep on having the same electoral system with that level of polarization and fragmentation, can get a quite extreme government on, let's say, less than a third of the vote. So that can create very different outcomes with the same underlying patterns of voting behaviour.
They'll just have to learn about post-election arrangements, not pre-election ones. That'll be the big difference, won't it?
Well, if you win an outright majority, you don't need a post-election arrangement. You can just, we have a government now and 34% of the vote with 66% of the seats.
Right, I'm going to open this to the audience now. Let's have some ground rules here. Let's try and keep the questions, if possible, not comments, and if comments, not too long. Or is a question in 8 parts?
You just open the floodgates.
So And I'll come up. I promise you the grand circle will get a chance. So, who would like to... a lot of hands. Right. Where? So, I'll take one, two. Let's take two together here, the front.
Thank you very much.
Say who you are, if you'd like.
Sorry, all right. Dennis McShane. My first political experience in 1972, representing the Selliote Labour Party of Birmingham in Labour's conference before the referendum then on Europe. And I've never been at such an orgy of Europe hate in my life. Nothing that Nigel Farage does or any of the anti-European Tories matches what the power of trade unions and the left were like in 1972, ranting. And they included Jack Straw and Robin Cook and lots of other people. The question very simply is this, that does the panel agree that there was not the slightest chance of winning this election because referendum, because no majority existed anywhere in Europe to leave Europe at that time? And every referendum in Europe this century, in any country, and aspects of the EU joined this regulation that, have resulted in a defeat for any ballot paper that had the EU on it. And just if I may, because we've had some very interesting figures, that just check, because I've got the figures here in front of me.
Let him do a bit more. Go on. Dennis, go on. Quickly, though.
All right. Well done, okay,
fair enough. I'll take one more intervention here. Microphone along the front.
Hey, I'm Asa, but as a young person, I kind of have to ask about, I noticed what you were saying about social media, and I'm curious as to what you're thinking about tribalism, and to what extent do you think Brexit was enabled by social media, and to what extent do you think that fracturing of political establishment has been caused by social media? I mean, I'd be interested from the philosophical, or I mean, from the psychological perspective, but I'm really interested to hear what all of you have to say.
Okay, so two questions. One is, in effect, that the EU is not popular in votes, and the other is social media. So who'd like to go on, Anna, and I'm going to go to you for that first one.
Well, I want to do the second one.
Hopeless. Sorry, not you. All right, answer the second one.
I mean, I think social media has become very important in the sense that, I mean, social media has become really ugly, the way the X algorithm has changed. I mean, I miss Twitter. I really miss good Twitter, because Twitter now is just horrible. And I think that is reinforcing echo chambers and the like. And you can actually see it in the rise of Restore, the power of social media, because actually that is their only channel. And it is quite remarkable how well they're doing. I mean, they're polling about 8% in Makerfield at the moment. I don't think it was such a big deal in 2016, actually. I think that was before peak Twitter. So I'm sure the campaigns use social media and use digital advertising. I don't think it was as divisive, as pervasive, or as prone to form separate worlds and separate echo chambers as it is now. But I think it is a real problem now in politics.
Emma.
I think absolutely it's crucial. And I think what we need to remember is that, when Musk is trying to inflame people on social media, when he is telling people to go out and riot or whatever, rage is a business model. You know, that's how you get attention. So maybe he is that kind of person anyway. But for all of these companies, rage engages people, engagement makes the money. And I think it's absolutely terrifying, and I think we have no idea what to do with this.
Okay, Sarah.
I wanted to address Dennis McShane. First of all, I think we should give him credit for writing a book before Brexit about how Brexit will happen. So most people didn't have that kind of level. Of course, the Remain side had a chance of winning. I think Matthew worked very hard, on his side, and I'm sure you would have known. I mean, you don't have a 52-48 referendum result and then being like, oh, it was definitely preordained. In fact, I think I was sitting, not on this stage, but in another room on the evening, and I think most people, I remember we were asked by the panel, and I'm a political scientist, I don't like predicting anything, oh God, because then you could be wrong. I'm much more like explaining it afterwards. But I remember being asked, and I said, well, I didn't want to call it because I said it's within the balance. You know, the polls were so close, so as a kind of someone who understands uncertainty and margin of error, it was too close. So, and also at that point, unlike now, opinions were quite malleable for a lot of people. They could have sort of gone either way. So it was a very divided public, and it wasn't clear that it couldn't have been won the other way, although not by a huge majority, but I think it could. And that is what we see in a lot of referendums. I mean, I've studied referendums for 30 years, and the thing I found fascinating about them is exactly that people's views are very malleable, which is why I would always recommend to any prime minister, if you don't have to, absolutely do not call a referendum.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Can I make two observations about the...
What's the advice given, you know, you're the world's greatest campaigner, I really doubt. What advice would you have given to the Remain campaign, given Dennis McShane's point about
the Rejoin campaign?
Okay.
No, just seriously, what would you have told them that they were doing wrong, given that there were people who always were suspicious of the EU, particularly on the left, and not only on the left?
One crucial point was the fact that David Cameron accepted the renegotiation deal that he was offered in February 2016. He had until basically the end of 2017 to do the referendum. He said he'd have it in the first half of the parliament, I think was his phrase.
Yeah, too early.
So he had basically another 18 months longer than that in which to hold it. He could have said, no, this isn't good enough. I want a different deal. And what's interesting is actually a few months after his renegotiation, the EU started to do different backstops to freedom of movement, didn't they, across the EU? Merkel brought that in. So had those sort of things started to come in, you know, EU-wide, perhaps that would be enough to flip, you know, 2% within the vote. That's an interesting point. I think in terms of the inevitable point as well, you're right to focus on the role of Labour within this. And it's interesting the polling towards the end of the campaign when you asked voters, you know, where did Labour stand in the referendum? There was actually not very high knowledge about where the Labour Party was because they heard, you know, Gisela Stewart and Kate Hoey and people on the Leave side, and Jeremy Corbyn was sort of nowhere to be seen. So had you had Ed Miliband or somebody else, you know, out there, you know, banging the drum and leading the Labour Party during that campaign, I think that would have been very different and definitely also worth more than 2%.
Be good. Now, we've had two male questioners. I'd really like to have one or two female questions soon. One there, one here. Let's do these two. So I've had to point out. It's the only way I can get the microphone to you and then into the middle in here. Yeah. If you'd like to, say who you are.
My name's Inez. I graduated from LSE last year. I think it's really interesting how you spoke about the Leave campaign, being very positively driven, and the Remain campaign being the opposite of that. I think the Leave campaign was actually quite driven by fear as well. And I guess my question to you is, what do you make of that? I think the idea of taking back control is implies that there's something being taken from us. I think rhetoric around immigration has the same effect. I think slapping £350 million on the side of a bus does exactly the same thing, that all these things are being taken from us. And yeah, so I suppose my question is, what do you make of that?
Okay, great question. That's short and sharp. And in the middle, there we are. Sorry, you're right isolated, right in the middle. It's like in the middle of the country, really. And I'll come up to you up there next, I promise.
Hi, I'm Eleanor. I'm an A-level politics student. I was wondering, you spoke about how you'd never advise a prime minister to call a referendum unless he had to. And I was wondering, referendums were really reaching a rise. We had one 2011, 2014, and 2016. And then the emotional fallout of this 2016 referendum, it's gone quiet. Do you think that in the next 20 or so years we'll actually see a referendum, or will it have to be until the Brexit has really cooled down before we can even revisit that road?
Okay, so Both great questions. So it wasn't just optimistic, Matthew. The take back control and some of the images, it's true on the other part of the Leave side mostly, were not massively optimistic, were they? Which is why you ran a separate campaign.
I think if you... there was polling done after the referendum asking people which campaign they felt was more positive. And they said the Leave campaign was more positive compared to the Remain campaign. So that's worth looking at in terms of public opinion. But I think there's a wider point about political campaigning. And it's true that basically messages about the consequences of things and trying to stop things, and I think you described it as sort of fear, as you described it, that does drive people more than more positive messages. That's sort of just the nature of campaigning. If you look at election campaigns, referendum campaigns across the world, those type of strategies do move people more.
Okay.
On the question about the will there be another referendum, I think there has to be another referendum if a party decides to rejoin the EU. And it's very interesting that parties on the left in the UK are tiptoeing towards talking about rejoin. And at the same time, I don't see there being, as I was saying, the idea of being a sort of, you know, a pick and mix approach. So the idea we can have sort of a single market in, join the single market for goods and that sort of thing, I don't think it's going to happen. You know, the EU will say, well, if you want to rejoin, you've got to rejoin the full thing, and you know, no rebate and freedom of movement, all that sort of stuff. And similarly, some of the member states have started saying as well, if you decide to do that, you have to have a referendum to make that, to confirm that. They won't allow just a simple vote at a general election. They want to actually feel that the British people have changed their minds in a democratic way and a significant way towards that. And I just can't see that happening, because if you look at the polling, coming back to the question before about where the state of public opinion is, if you dig down into the polling and start saying to people, OK, well, if we were to rejoin, it would mean, you know, paying the membership fee again, 28 billion, freedom of movement, etc., etc., it quickly swings the other way. So, again, I think Leave would win, or Stay Out, as it would be, would win that campaign again.
And presumably, therefore, and we've begun to get intimations of this, another way of doing this would be step by step, with it being written into parties' manifestos, which are deemed to carry the doctrine of the mandate with them, which it looks to me like the way Labour again, that we'll start to write things on our into our manifesto, they're saying. Is that true? Is that the way they're going?
I mean, there are people in the Labour Party who are saying we should just not have a referendum and stick it in a manifesto. Yeah. I think there are lots of problems with that. Firstly, that we've had two referendums on this already, so this might be perceived as a way of avoiding
Become a referendum indirectly.
And I think the second thing is, rejoin will be complicated and will probably take up more than one election. So it's not just a question of winning the first one. I think the most fun thing about rejoin is that the French will almost certainly have to have a referendum on whether to let us in, which would be fantastic. It's
great. I mean, more generally, there are just more referendums. I mean, and part of that is what we talked about, is the rise of populist parties on the left and on the right. They love the idea of referendums. More than, because the whole sort of ethos of it is that, you know, that it should be the people over the sort of corrupt elite, and how do you get, and it's also a much more majoritarian view of politics, which is the one espoused in referendums, you know, the majority, the winner takes it all. So in that sense, you know, let's say you had a reform government, they want referendums and lots of things. So I think the general trend is one towards more referendums, not necessarily on the EU, but on other things, which is of course not, you know, a long tradition in British politics, but if you look across Europe, it used to, I mean, the Swiss have always been obsessed with them, but everywhere else it's also on the rise.
Yes, actually it's odd, isn't it? One of the best run countries in the world has lots of referendums, Switzerland, and also one of the worst run places in the world, California, has
but look at how the Swiss react to referendum results, unlike the Brits. They take a different approach.
Yeah. But I think this last one was so painful for this country that I really don't want to go back there. And whatever a potential future reform government might say, I don't think there's appetite for another one here for a very long time.
So, referendum, or whether there should be no referendums ever again. I think that might win. Right. Yes, oh, goodness gracious, this is going to be difficult. Right at the back there, gentlemen there, and then lady here. Yes, you. So, you then here. So,
the lady first.
One of you speak. Yes, go for it.
Yeah?
You're on.
I'm not blaming any of the panelists for this. I'm very conscious that this is caused by the title of this event, but we've spent the last hour talking about Britain's political future, and I wonder if I could lure you beyond scope to talk about the UK's political future, because there is a nation missing from this evening. I would be very interested, as a citizen of the Republic of Ireland, to understand what the panellists' views are on the role of Northern Ireland and where this may inevitably go in the coming years.
Can I ask you a question, as you from the Republic of Ireland? I mean, I was going to ask the panellists, but I'm going to reverse it and ask you. It's an amazing achievement of diplomacy and politics that the impossibility of the open border, the common travel area between the Republic and the UK, somehow got sorted out. How do you think it got? I mean, you know, you're into that. How do you think it got sorted out?
I think it's a constant kind of tension that's always going to sit there, right? Like, it's never really going to be. I disagree that it is sorted out. This is something that is always going to remain as a tension. It's not a helpful answer, but I think it's something that will constantly reemerge. There will always be, you know, a particular new element that's going to challenge the status quo one way or another. But frankly, you know, we're only, barely 30 years past the Good Friday Agreement. I don't think we were really ready for the questions that started being posed to my island as a result of what happened in 2016. Yeah. And I promise you that any more future questions about the future of that island, we're still not ready to answer them.
Okay.
Brexit has brought it up faster than we were really able to handle.
Okay, it's a great question. So thank you for chiding me rightly for that. And gentlemen over there.
Thank you for selecting me. Basically,
can you speak up a little bit?
Basically, when I, you know, travel around the country and talk to people about Brexit, I get this sense of trauma, both for the Leavers and Remainers. So, to what extent is that sort of sense of trauma true,
or is the trauma? My hearing. Yeah. Sorry. Keep going.
Or is it fabricated by people around you or by the media? And to what extent is that sort of crisis of identity so strong, that trauma so strong, that it's going to be carried on to the next generations that, turn from my dad vote for Labour to my dad vote for Remain, stuff like that.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, it's great, and that's definitely right, and that's where Sarah's book's really about, that issue of trauma. What about the UK and Ireland? In the sense of the question, the insoluble and obviously not fully solved, Northern Ireland border trilemma, as it was called. And yet it did get sorted out up to a point, but tell me why I'm wrong about thinking, and indeed the questioner disagrees with me, that it's sort of sorted.
Well, it's sort of sorted because we've got the Windsor framework, which now means that both sides can just about live with where we are. It's very, very uncertain. The EU, actually, behind the scenes, is still saying that the UK hasn't implemented all that it should have done under the Windsor framework. It's very, very difficult because the problem with the situation in Northern Ireland, apart from, let's be honest, the absolute weirdness of having a customs and regulatory border within a sovereign country is quite remarkable, is that it's very linked to the politics of Northern Ireland as well. And one of the sad things, I think, about the Brexit debate, there's two things that struck me about the Brexit debate. Firstly, was the absolute, utter, staggering pig ignorance of the British state about how Northern Ireland worked and how its future was bound up with EU. Our devolution settlement is predicated still on EU membership, okay, which is one of the reasons why it's struggling at the moment. We've got all these patches like the Internal Market Act. The second thing is, because the community split along Brexit lines, a sectarianism that actually was in abeyance to a significant extent before that referendum came back stronger than ever. And of course, one of the legacies of Brexit is, just in case the people in Northern Ireland wanted to forget, every 4 years they have this consent vote, which will reopen those old wounds again. So it's definitely had a significant impact on the politics of Northern Ireland. And will continue to have a significant impact on the politics of Northern Ireland. The gamble from the UK government is that the Windsor framework, by providing Northern Ireland with this unique situation of market access to the two markets, will actually lead to economic improvements that support for the status quo, support for the protocol, will increase over time. And there is some evidence, if you look at the polling that Katie Hayward and David Finnemore do at QUB regularly, that actually support for the protocol is rising in Northern Ireland. But we'll see what the future holds.
And the
Do you want to go first?
Well, just on that, I mean, I suspect that when the history of the reunification of the island of Ireland is written, Brexit will be an important staging post. And one of the reasons is the fact that I think you were politely gesturing towards, which is we weren't talking about Northern Ireland. Westminster doesn't think about Northern Ireland. We simply forgot that there might be a really significant problem there, and it turned out there was a really significant problem, and it had impacts on the politics of Northern Ireland as well as on the politics of this country as a whole. And it was one of the things that made our polity look particularly shameful.
Shall I answer the other question?
Yes.
So the other question was about your feeling that when you go around the UK, you think people are still traumatised by Brexit, and that's an overriding factor. What strikes me more, actually, if you look at public opinion, is the fact that actually the key issues that concern people, the top three issues of basically the economy, NHS, migration, which sometimes vary in ordering, but they're basically static and they're the same today as they were back in 2016 and were in 2006. It's always a sort of mix of issues. And I wonder whether some of the feelings you're picking up when you go in the country are actually more to do with dissatisfaction with politicians and the political class. And I think it's important to see 2016 as always being a bit of a cry from the country, for that 52% they want something done differently. And that cry happened again in 2019, in the general election then, and the European election, actually, in 2019. And you could argue it happened to a certain extent in 2024. They're looking for the Labour Party to bring that change in. I think change was the key word on the Labour Party's manifesto. And again, they feel that that change hasn't happened. And of course, since the 2024 general election, you've seen the rise of reform, of course, and restore, which has been talked about briefly, and of course the Green Party on the left. So I think there is that yearning there for change, which hasn't been satisfied by any of the traditional political parties.
Now, have you got some? I'm just going to got an online question. Do you want to? You're on. Who's it from, if you know?
Yes, we have a question from Anthony, an LSE external alumnus, which is a what if. If, as the EU GDP was equal to the US GDP before Brexit, if the UK had stayed, would UK-EU be a power on par with Trump and Xi Jinping today?
So if the UK had stayed in the EU, would it have made Europe more powerful and more likely to stand up to Donald Trump?
Yes,
paraphrase that
so.
Accurately?
I think so, yes.
Right, who'd like to have a go at that one? Good question.
I don't think that would have happened. You know, if you rewind back to roughly the year 2000, I would say that roughly US GDP was similar to EU GDP, more or less. Now it's about sort of 40% lower, isn't it? If you look overall, because of the tech boom. Basically, the US's tech boom and the low energy costs has driven huge growth within the US in that period, which is why sort of GDP per capita has gone up so much. Another way to look at it, of course, in the States is where would the UK be, or do I say it, France, Germany, Italy, were it to be a US state, it'd be poorer than Mississippi, so it'd be poorer than any other US state. So the US has really taken off at that time. Now, of course, in the past year, there's been the trade war and things have cooled down within the UK economy, but the story of basically the year 2000 right to now has been the US taking off in a big way and Europe, since financial crisis, basically stagnating.
That's absolutely right, but the larger the economic bloc the EU was, the greater the chance it would have had to stand up against Trump's tariffs, for instance. And the consequence of the fragmentation of the EU is that we are now stuck between, as it were, kind of three large economic and political blocs, the EU, China and America, and we're very small and vulnerable.
Although we have a better trade deal with the US than the EU.
not Susie so Lucci.
Anna. Well, I mean, that's
true.
Anna, for the chair to have an argument. Anna, go on.
I mean, I'll just say, I don't think the reason why the EU caved on Trump's tariffs was anything to do with the size of the EU economy. It was because we're utterly dependent on them for our security. And I think that would have been the case with the UK in or the UK out. The reason why we can't negotiate with Trump is we're terrified about him undermining NATO. It's not because the EU has the heft to respond to the US now, if it wants to, and has proven repeatedly with other countries that if it wields some of its more offensive trade weapons, it can be quite good at doing so. But it doesn't dare with the United States because we're so utterly reliant on them.
But NATO's over. I mean, we can't rely on it. You can't rely on an unreliable ally, and America has proved itself to be an unreliable ally. I mean, an unreliable ally is kind of a contradiction in terms.
The point is we have no choice at the moment. So at the moment, we're just sitting around crossing our fingers and hoping the worst doesn't come to the worst, while some in Europe are talking about gaining more autonomy and more self-reliance. But for the moment, we have put ourselves collectively, Europe as a whole, in a position of security dependence.
But we are now all spending more money on defence. We are now all acting together more than we used to. So there is something happening within
and
Europe.
It is a paradox that... Sorry, I'm not supposed to join in, am I?
Join
in. It is a paradox, though, that... not that much of a paradox, that Donald Trump has pushed Europe back together again. I mean, self-evidently, he has made the relationship between the UK and the EU, still despite all the trade and all the history, referendum, a little bit better than it was.
And before that, Brexit did. I mean, that's the other kind of paradox, of that by having a very, big, by EU terms, powerful nation leaving, what it has done across the continent is that people who were before kind of Eurosceptic are now less what we can think of as exit Eurosceptic, because they looked at Britain and they think, God, if they can't figure out how to leave in a way that really, Matthew's analysis, notwithstanding, really looks from the outside like a massive success. And it doesn't to European. If you survey Europeans, it looks like it's been a bit of a disaster. And part of that was a very long period it took for us to be. So people look at the UK and they couldn't get in. And we were much more removed, like not being in the euro and so on. So it looks like we don't want that. And also what's happened on the sort of Eurosceptic right is they no longer advocate the way they do on exit referendums, because they look at Britain and they think, oh God, no, it's not popular.
And not just in Europe. I mean, did you see Mark Carney was using Britain as a warning to Canadian separatists about what might happen to them if they went in?
But he also used it as a tool to win his election, in the sense that you could argue there will be very compelling reasons why Canada should be further integrated with the US. It's got a common border, it's got a common language, it sort of has an economy that overlaps in a big way. So you could argue, from a sort of pro-European point of view, why isn't Canada close to the US? And I would say that with Canada, it's very logical. It's a sovereign country, has its own history, wants to make its own laws. Fine, that's like the UK.
Okay, let's move on. Moving swiftly on. Now, take one at the front here, and take two of you together at the... two together there. Sorry, everybody. I'll come to you next, promise. Right, short and sharp, otherwise they won't get a question.
Alex McKenna, I should declare my interest of working with the chair in the Department of Government. But a question for Lord Elliott. Going back to your opening remarks about UK in the 1990s, 3% growth, all this kind of stuff, a lot of the discussion now focuses on the period afterwards, a kind of a bleak one of that you also touched on about disenchantment of the public with politicians and so on. But Brexit as an idea is arguably something of a kind of leftover of that 90s optimism. That's where many of the ideas originated from. Britain booming, USSR defeated, the end of history, as some people would have it, and the idea that, therefore, the UK leaving the EU was a relatively safe bet. So do we need to understand more about that earlier history, in terms of understanding why it happened, and maybe also the kind of psychological headspace of some of the key players like Dominic Cummings and yourself? Were you not perhaps stuck in a kind of happy world of your youth as a student at the LSE in the 90s?
Okay, don't answer that. I'm going to take three or four together now, while you think. I'll take
one there, you deserve it for persistence, and one here, so that's three. Yep.
So I really appreciate your talking about how Brexit happened and the legacy that it left, but I'd be really curious to know what you think about the process of Brexit and what it revealed about the British democratic model. It's often been talked about as this moment of tension between parliamentary sovereignty and the quote-unquote will of the people, and I'm curious what you make of why it was so hard once that referendum mandate was in to quote-unquote get Brexit done, and the multitude of leadership reshuffles and rise of populism and shifts in the two-party British democratic model that have happened since.
Yep, great question as well. Now the very, very hard-working... Yeah, go for it.
I feel like I have high expectations now. I'm Sasha, I'm an A-level politics student, and I'm asking, would you say that the success of Project Fear from the Remain campaign has allowed for, if not catalysed, the rise of far-right populist politics as its inversion, where in recognising its success, instead of simply capitalising on fear, political figures and leaders such as Farage and Tommy Robinson combine fear with rage and exploit it, channelling it into the form of xenophobia?
Okay, very good. And at the front here, yes, waiting patiently.
I'd like to hear the panel's thoughts on Britain's economic future, especially around economic inequality. Arguably, many people voted leave because they were feeling left behind and not listened to, etc., and they wanted Britain to chart its own course. Are these people better off? Are they still feeling left behind? So what do you think about inequality in Britain's future?
Okay, all good questions. Right, there's four there. You don't have all to answer all of them, as they say at this time of night. Let's do the inequality one first. The last shall come first. So, if we believe, and I think all the evidence we've seen subsequently, is that people who voted to leave, in part, were doing so for all sorts of reasons that embraced the idea that they were not doing well out of a post-industrial economy. Has what's happened since addressed that?
You did a whole TED talk on that.
You did a whole TED talk on that. You do a 1 minute version of a TED talk.
A great TED talk.
12 minutes or nothing, I'm sorry. I mean, what was interesting about Brexit and its aftermath was, if you remember the Conservative Party post-referendum, it suddenly became massively concerned about inequality, which wasn't the Conservative Party of the Cameron-Osborne era at all. You know, Theresa May talked about the just about managings, about burning injustices. Boris Johnson talked about levelling up. And there was a real moment post-Brexit where I thought, OK, this makes perfect sense. We might end up with an economy that is perhaps a little bit smaller than it would have been had we remained in, but one that is significantly fairer because it's taken a referendum to flag to our politicians the fact that this just isn't working for last wages of the country that have been overlooked. And I think the profound tragedy of Brexit is that nothing was actually done. There were a lot of fine words, very little in the way of action. This government hardly talks about regional inequality, which is a shame, given that it's a Labour government. But I just thought there was a moment. And just this sort of reinforces what Matthew said, is, you know, the people voted for change. They've done it repeatedly. They did it in 2016, they did it in 2019, they did it again in 2024, and they've seen nothing. They've seen no fruits of this. And I think, you know, when talking about populism, you know, there was a question about whether the Brexit playbook has led to populism. It might have given us some ideas, but let's be under no illusions about this. The popularity of populism is down to the failure of the political mainstream to deliver. And that's something that the centrist parties might want to spend a little bit more time pondering, I think.
Because you brought up rage, and the question has brought up rage and fear.
Yeah, I think regional inequality was one of the big issues behind Brexit. And, you know, Boris banged on about it. Did we seriously think he was going to do anything about it? Of course not. He has an attention span of 5 minutes. Regional inequality is something that takes decades to even start changing. Our political system does not have the attention span to deal with something like regional inequality. And as to broad income inequality across society, I don't have any hope for improving that in the near future. We have a national debt that is about the size of GDP at the moment, and mostly in order to remedy problems of inequality, you need more state intervention, and we cannot afford higher levels of state spending at the moment. You know, we need to do everything we can to get our economy growing at all if we're going to finance the public services that we have at the moment. So I really don't think that inequality, regional or income inequality, is going to improve in the near future.
Now, the end of history point, that's probably aimed at you. What was the longer lead up that took us to the point of running
it's a very clever question. I liked how you framed it. But I think that I'll stick with what I said at the beginning, that for me, the longer point about the sort of history developing was the fact that the EU is declining in importance in the world. And like I said at the beginning, going from sort of 35% of GDP, you know, dominating the world, now down to about 15% of GDP and declining even further. So for me, it's still a smart thing to be outside of the EU. On the regional inequality point, which I think is an important one thing that hasn't been mentioned so much this evening is, from the past 10 years, is of course COVID and the whole COVID experience. And of course that meant that, you know, for example, when Boris had got back in with his majority of 80 and just got Brexit done with in January 2020, at that point, when you might have thought he would have sort of been outlining his vision for the UK outside of the EU, COVID hit, which saw things up. Then, of course, Partygate, and then the sort of disaster of the change to the Prime Minister. That was a huge element, which we haven't really talked about very much at all. And the other COVID point is, what would Boris Johnson have done with government spending had it not been for COVID? And I've got a feeling he would have actually increased government spending and used the money rather than for furlough and the other things that went on with the big COVID spends on things like levelling up. And that's the what if, which we'll never quite know what would have happened had we not had COVID. On the question of Project Fear and the rise of restore and reform, that was one of the questions I can't remember where it came from, A-level politics student over there. One thing that struck me writing the book was actually how public opinion has changed when it comes to the questions of migration. I think back to, you know, a week out from the referendum, and you had the Nigel Farage's Breaking Point poster, and I thought it was going to completely sort of blow up the campaign and, you know, isolate those swing voters we were hoping to win over. Fast forward 10 years to how politicians from other parties now talk about migration. Of course, last summer we had Keir Starmer talking about an island of strangers. Now, that's a phrase which, you know, had Farage used actually in the referendum, would have completely blown up the campaign. But 10 years later, you have a Labour Prime Minister using that sort of phrase. I think public opinion has changed in a big way when it comes to migration during that period. I think I covered all
the
points.
We need to... Sarah.
Just one under one question we didn't look at, which was the process of Brexit.
Yes.
A slightly different view from how you can do the post-Brexit political compromise differently. So in 92, the Danes voted against the Maastricht Treaty. Like, you know, no one in... The Europeans were just like, you sort it out or you're out, basically. I mean, it's Denmark, who cares? But the thing is, that was also a close referendum, like the one we had in Britain. But whereas in Britain, the adversarial politics of Britain is sort of, oh, the winner takes it all, you know, Theresa May, Brexit means Brexit. Whereas the Danish parties, I think, realise, no, we all have to come together, including, you know, most mainstream parties would have wanted to stay in the EU and the Maastricht Treaty, but also with the parties that had campaigned against it, and find what they called the national compromise. Now, they then did have a second referendum on that, which is why, for example, Denmark is outside the EU and so on. But I thought it was just a very different way of doing post-referendum politics. So Britain does this very majoritarian, adversarial thing that means, going back to the questions about trauma and your point about bereavement, it left 48% of the population just feeling you just don't have a say because you lost. And yes, they did lose, but this was But you could also have taken a different approach, and that was, well, let's find a solution, leaving the EU, but one that is a national compromise for the country. And that was not the one taken, and I think that is partly to do with how British politics operate in this the-winner-takes-it-all adversarial way, which I think was not particularly healthy for Britain in the 10 years that has gone since then.
Okay. Spontaneous round of applause is a good point to end the evening. So first, before I thank our excellent panel, indeed our even more wonderful audience, I'm encouraged to advertise an event in the LSE Festival, which is about the politics of climate change. So everybody in the audience is interested in politics. You can move on to a different subject. That's in the festival on Monday, the 15th of June, from 1:30 to 2:30. Look at the LSE's events website or festival website for that. There will be refreshment outside, and you can look at the exhibits from the library. So I'd like to thank the London people, actually. Obviously, our panel, Matthew, Emma, Sarah, and Anand. I'd also like to thank Kay, Owen, and all our excellent stewards this evening.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.